I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is writer Julie Oringer. She's joined in conversation by novelist and essayist Ayelet Waldman. And now, join Stephanie Singer on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Julie Oringer and Ayelet Waldman.
Julie Oringer is the best-selling author of the novel The Invisible Bridge and the award-winning short story collection How to Breathe Underwater, which was a New York Times notable book. She's the winner of the Paris Review's Plimpton Prize for Fiction and a recipient of fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, Stanford University, and the Dorothy and Lewis B. Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers at the New York Public Library. Julie's here this evening to discuss her second novel, The Flight Portfolio, a brilliantly conceived dramatization of the remarkable story of American journalist Varian Fry, who rescued more than 2,000 Jewish dissidents and artists from Nazi-occupied France, including Hannah Arendt, Max Ernst, and Marc Chagall. Cynthia Ozick, in her New York Times review, calls The Flight Portfolio, quote, a sympathetic and prodigiously ambitious novel. And we not only agree with her assessment, but we think it's destined to become a classic. Appearing with Julie this evening is Ayelet Waldman. Ayelet is the author of A Really Good Day, How Microdosing Made a Mega Difference in My Mood, My Marriage, and My Life, and the novels Love and Treasure, Red Hook Road, Love and Other Impossible Pursuits, and Daughter's Keeper. She's also written or edited several collections, including Bad Mother, A Chronicle of Maternal Crimes, Minor Calamities, and Occasional Moments of Grace, and Kingdom of Olives and Ash, Writers Confront the Occupation. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Julie Oringer and Ayelet Waldman.
I'm so excited to be here because this book is so incredibly, deliciously magnificent. So I want to get started right away. So I want you to give us an introduction to this incredible character who is, in fact, was larger than life. So who is Varian Fry?
Okay. Hi, guys. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. It's really nice to see this group here at the JCC. I'm so happy to be in San Francisco. I lived here for 10 years. It's always like a homecoming when I come back, which I do a couple times a year. But it's especially great to be here where I believe I talked about this book like when it was in the earliest stages of conception. And so it's amazing to actually be sitting here with it as a thing on my lap. So thanks for coming out for this. I'm going to read to you a brief chapter from the very beginning. And don't worry when I say chapter. It really is only a few pages. Because it's at the beginning, it doesn't really need introduction, but I do actually feel like it's worth giving you the section title at least, which is Despise What Is Not Courage, which is a line from an E. Cummings poem. But the chapter is called Gordes, which is a place name in the south of France. There was, as it turned out, no train to the village where the Chagalls lived, one of many complications he'd failed to anticipate. He had to pay a boy with a motorbike to run him up from the station at Cavaillon, 10 miles at a brain-shaking pace along a narrow, rutted road. On either side rose ochre hills, striated with grapevines and lavender and olive trees, overhead a blinding white-veined sky. The smell was of the boy's leather jacket and of charred potatoes, exhalate of his clever homemade fuel. At the foot of the village, the boy parked in a shadow, accepted Varian's francs, and tore off into the distance before Varian could arrange a ride back. The streets of Gordes, carved into a sunstruck limestone hill above the Luberon Valley, offered little in the way of shade. He would have given anything to be back in Marseille with a glass of apéro before him, watching sailors and girls, gangsters and spice vendors, parading the canebière. The Chagalls had only agreed to see him on the basis that he not bring up the prospect of their emigration. But what other subject was there? The Nazis had taken Paris months ago. They were burning books in the streets of Alsace. they could send any refugee over the border at will. At least the Chagalls had agreed. That was something. But as he reached the house, an ancient Catholic girls' school on the Rue de la Fontaine Basse, he found himself fighting the urge to flee. His credentials, if anyone examined them, amounted to a fanatic's knowledge of European history, a desire to get out from behind his desk in New York, and a deep frustration with his isolationist nation. And yet, this was his job. He'd volunteered for it. What was more, he believed he could do it. He raised his hand and knocked. An eye appeared in the brass circlet of the peephole, and a girl in a striped apron opened the door. She listened, strangling her index finger with one dark curl as he stated his name and mission. Then she ushered him down a corridor and out into a courtyard where a stone path led to a triangle of shade. There, at a bare wooden table, Chagall and his wife sat at lunch, the painter in his smock, his hair swept back from his forehead in silver waves, Bella in a close-fitting black dress, too hot for the day. "Ah, Monsieur Fry," Chagall said, rising to meet him. The painter's eyes were large and uncommonly sharp, his expression one of bemusement. "You've come, after all. I thought you might. You won't forget our agreement, will you? All I want is your company for an hour." "You're lying, of course, but you lie charmingly." They sat together at the table, Bella on Varian's left, the painter to his right, he, Varian Fry, sitting down with the Chagalls, with Chagall, author of those color-saturated visions, those buoyant bridal couples and intelligent-eyed goats he'd seen in hushed rooms at the Museum of Modern Art. Bella filled a plate with brown, hard-crusted miche, soft cheese, sardines crackling with salt. She handed it across the table, assessing Varian in silence. "Had you been here a few days ago, we would have had tomatoes," Chagall said. "A farmer brings them up to the market on Thursdays. I'm sorry we don't have more to offer. The bread's a little hard on the tooth, I'm afraid. But c'est la guerre." "This is lavish," Varian said. "You're too kind." "Not at all. We like to share what we have." He gestured around him at the bare yellow stones, the rough benches, the shock of gold-green hillside visible through an archway in the wall. "As you see, we're living a quiet and retired life in our little dasha. No one will bother us here at Gord." "You have a studio," Varian said. "You're still producing work. That's what makes you dangerous." "Our daughter says the same," Bella said. "She's been saying it for months. But you understand, Monsieur Fry, my husband's reputation will protect him. Vichy wouldn't dare touch us." "With respect, Madame Chagall, I don't believe that for a moment. Vichy is subject to the Nazis' whims, and we all know what they're capable of. I've seen it myself. I was in Berlin in 35, sent by the magazine I worked for. My last night in town, there was a riot on the Kurfürstendamm. The things I saw, men pulled from their shops and beaten in the streets, an old man stabbed through the hand at a cafe table, boys dragging a woman by her hair. These things happen in Germany," Chagall said, his tone harder now. "They won't happen here, not to us." "Let me speak to my friend at the consulate," Varian said. "Ask him to start a file for you at least. If you do decide to leave, it might take months." Chagall shook his head. "My apologies, Monsieur Fry. I'm sorry you had to come all this way in vain. But perhaps you'd like to have a look at the studio before you go. If you've finished, that is." Varian couldn't speak. He could scarcely believe that a person of Chagall's intelligence, a person of his experience, could fail to see what he himself saw clearly. Chagall rose and crossed the courtyard to a set of 10-foot-high blue doors, and Varian got to his feet. He nodded his thanks to Bella, then followed Chagall across the broken paving stones. Beyond the blue doors was a long, high-ceilinged room with a wall of windows, the former refectory of the girls' school. Canvases lay about everywhere, and for long minutes Varian walked among them in silence. As well as he knew the painter's work, he had never seen it like this, in its pupil state, damp and mutable, smelling of turpentine, raw wood, wet clay. From the canvases rose ghost-like images, a grave-eyed Madonna hovering above a shadowed town, serenaded by cows and angels, crucified Christ wrapped in a prayer shawl, his head encircled by grieving sages, a woman kneeling beside a river, pressing a baby to her chest, clusters of red and white flowers rising like flames. "It's no small matter to cross an ocean," Chagall said. "More can be lost than canvas and paint. An artist must bear witness, Monsieur Fry. He cannot turn away even if he wishes to. An artist can't bear witness if he's dead. The painter removed his hat and set it on his knee. The emergency rescue committee mustn't concern itself further with our welfare, he said. Save your resources for those who truly need help. Max Ernst, for example. He's rumored to be in a concentration camp at Gur. Or Jacques Lipschitz, my friend from Montparnasse. Who knows where he's fled to now? Or Lev Zilberman, who painted those massive murals in Berlin. Yes, I know Zilberman's work. Alfred Barr fought to get him on our list. You're not entirely on the wrong path, then. Help Ernst. Help Zilberman. Not me. And he turned away from Varian toward his canvases, toward the brushes and knives, the wooden boxes cluttered with crushed tubes of paint. I'll mention your name among our circles, he said. I know plenty who are eager to leave. Varian stumbled along the road toward Cavaillon, down the hill he'd seen through the courtyard arch. It would take him 2 hours to reach the station at this rate, another two on the train after that, and then he'd be back in Marseille, having made no progress at all. And what would he report to his colleagues in New York, to Paul Hagen, who directed the Emergency Rescue Committee, or to Frank Kingdon, its chair? That summer, when he and Paul and Ingrid Warburg and Alfred Barr and the others had compiled their list, 200 artists, writers, and intellectuals who'd been blacklisted by the Gestapo and had no way out of France. They hadn't imagined that their clients might resist being helped, nor that they'd consider themselves beyond Vichy's reach. There were so many things they hadn't considered. His life in France had become a process of discovering them, often to his embarrassment. It was a miracle he'd managed to get anyone out at all. There had been only 12 so far, a minuscule fraction of his list. What he ought to do, he thought, as he kicked stones along the rutted road, was to write his wife that night to say he was coming home. He'd confess, and what a relief it would be, that his work wasn't going as planned. How had he imagined it would take a month, 1 month, to find and extract 200 endangered artists? He'd envisioned himself riding a rented bicycle through the countryside, rounding up refugees by the dozen as if they'd be waiting in the lemon orchards with traveling papers in hand. He'd imagined that the consulate would contort itself miraculously to help him. But then the chaos of this place, the innumerable bureaucratic barriers, the cretins in the U.S. visa office, the resistance of the artists themselves. What a mistake he'd made crawling out from behind his desk at the publishing house. How could he have presumed to take the lives of men like Chagall and Ernst into his hands when he had no idea how to manage them, no idea even of how to convince them they were in danger? Eileen wanted him home. She feared for his life. Her letter from last week had made that clear. Well, home he'd go. He'd write her at once. He'd write her as soon as he reached the Splendide. I'll stop there.
Okay. So tell us about the man. Tell us about Varian Fry.
Okay. So Varian Fry, who was born in the same town that you grew up in, Ridgewood,
I know, isn't
Jersey.
That insane? Ridgewood, New Jersey? What?
He was the child of a New York stockbroker and a person who suffered from depression. He went to a variety of boarding schools, dropped out of a number of boarding schools because he didn't like the hazing rituals there. He went to Harvard, where he studied classics and ran afoul of the administration for throwing raucous parties, driving his car recklessly, expounding on subjects that were perhaps not suitable for public expounding in the cafes of Cambridge. And eventually he got kicked out for putting a for sale sign on the dean's lawn. And then he graduated and married a phenomenally intelligent woman who is an editor at the Atlantic Monthly. They moved together to New York, and he became an editor for a magazine called The Living Age. They sent him over to Germany for a number of months so that he could see what it was like on the ground there. And he became extraordinarily knowledgeable about the political situation in Europe. And then he eventually became the director of an imprint of a publishing house, the focus of which was to publish works that illuminated the European political situation. So somewhere around the summer of, I guess it would have been, you know, it would have been maybe in early 1940. It wasn't yet summer. He and a number of other prominent New Yorkers decided that they wanted to form a committee that would have as its mission the identification of a certain number of artists who had been endangered by the Nazis in Europe and could be conceivably brought to the States if somebody could go over there and find them and get them traveling papers and find ways for them to get out. And so they raised a bunch of money, and then the question arose, who was going to be this person who was going to go to Europe and get the people out? The problem was that anybody who actually was knowledgeable enough about the process of emigration and who knew the artists and who could, who was well-connected enough to be able to find them and extract them would have been in danger themselves because they were all Europeans. And so Varian Fry volunteered for the job despite his having zero experience doing any relief work, any refugee work, anything remotely of the kind. So with that lack of experience, he got on a plane and went to Marseille in August of 1940 and had the misconception that I read about right. in this section. He thought it would be incredibly easy to find these 200 writers and artists on his list. And he met resistance at every turn. First of all, the south of France was this horrific tangle because after the Nazi occupation in June, people fled to the south of France in droves and there was this vast disorder. So the first difficulty was trying to find
right.
the people on the list. And then the problem was that there were innumerable bureaucratic barriers to emigration. Vichy did not want to let these people out because they knew they were valuable to the Nazis. And the United States didn't want to let them in because we were in a moment of profound xenophobia. We also didn't want writers and artists coming to the States who would effectively communicate to United States citizens what was actually going on in Europe, which would have made it impossible for us to justify our isolationist policies at the time. And so...
So hard to understand that kind of time period that United States seems so unfamiliar.
And so... So Varian's first job was to recruit a number of people to this project to help him out. And that was what he did. He assembled a group of colleagues who were vastly more knowledgeable than he was, and he found the one person in the U.S. visa office who would actually be willing to grant visas at the risk of his own job. And he made connections through the black market in Marseille, and he found the people who could start to conduct his clients over the Pyrenees to safety. And that was sort of how the whole thing started. It really started with the recognition of his own limitations, his own ignorance. And only from that point could he build an organization that would save lives.
So talk to me about this list. So the way they created the list and the sort of the, you know, when I was reading the book, I put myself in the position of these people and the idea of creating a list is incredibly compelling, right? Because these are you're looking at people like Chagall who are important not just to the people who love them, but to the world as a whole. But then there's also this real discomfort that you experience when reading the book and that you experience through his eyes of having a list at all, because a list means that some people will be saved and some people won't be. So talk to us a little bit about that list and how people got on it and how people got off it and why it... why they did it that way. And
yeah, let's talk about that because it really was a very difficult process, the assembling of that list. And it originated in New York in conversations with various Europeans who had come from that sort of miasma of occupied Europe and who knew the names of the artists who are in danger, and also from conversations with prominent Americans in the arts mm-hmm. who said, we really would like to help this person.
Right.
But there were entrenched arguments, even here in the States, about who the 200 people were going to be that the organization would save. The idea was that they would save those who were the finest minds in arts and letters. Mm-hmm. And they specifically focus on visual artists, on social democrats, even though that wasn't their primary focus. But the social democrats were considered to be so very important that they kind of had to be on everyone's list. Mm-hmm. And on those who had opposed the Nazis, mm-hmm. quite visibly in print or on the page.
You're listening to writer Julie Oringer, whose new novel is The Flight Portfolio. She's joined in conversation by Ayelet Waldman on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So, once Varian got to France, and he realized how dire the situation was, how much worse it was than they had anticipated in the States, the list began to grow. And when the word got out that there was this American who had set up an office in Marseille that was helping people to get their French exit visas, whether they were real exit visas or fake, and U.S. entry visas, and all of the necessary transit visas that could get somebody from France through Spain to Portugal and finally to the States, refugees started showing up at his door in droves. And he and his colleagues had to make these determinations about who was worth saving. And so there were certain people who were obvious clients, like Chagall or like Ernst. And then there were others who were marginal and questionable, such as this theology grad student who Walter Benjamin had been championing in Paris. His colleague Miriam Davenport came to him and said, I hear of this woman. She's written this marvelous treatise on the subject of love in St. Augustine. Can we help her? And he said, well, what's her name? And Davenport said, well, her name is Hannah Arendt, and she's supposed to be brilliant, according to Benjamin. And Varian said, well, I've never heard of her in my life. How are we supposed to know whether we should help her above the hundreds of others who come to us for aid? Well, fortunately for contemporary thought, Hannah Arendt did end up becoming a client of the Emergency Rescue Committee and making it to the States.
When I read about that, I kept thinking about the thousands who didn't. You know, I mean, the thousand equally great minds,
right,
who were in, you know, I thought specifically about Hannah Arendt and in the same field as Hannah Arendt and the other grad students and the college students. And it brought home to me in the most visceral way that catastrophe, the idea that the potential was cut short for millions upon millions of people. And some were just going to be, you know, mothers and fathers and, you know, whatever, butchers and bakers. And others were going to be, you know, might have been the most brilliant minds that we'll never know anything about.
Right, and I think that the moral dilemma that became clearer and clearer to Varian as he spent time in Marseille really was that there was no way of making a kind of qualitative judgment between somebody who was going to go on to become, you know, an incredible mind in philosophy and somebody who is going to become an incredible baker. I mean, these were all human beings. And so he came to question deeply the project that, you know, that had brought him to France. But I think we also have to recognize that a large part of the problem was that the United States was erecting these impenetrable barriers. I mean, consider the difference between the policies that made it, you know, that made it so very hard for him to argue to the consulate that these few visas must be granted, compared to the situation that my family faced after the Hungarian Revolution, where there was a blanket policy of asylum. Anybody who was a refugee from the Hungarian Revolution was granted asylum here in the States. Could my grandmother, who was a seamstress, or my grandfather, who was a window dresser for the National Department Store, have really made an argument for their artistry?
I'm sure not. Yeah, and I mean, you know, and there are other, we see those injustices now. We saw them then. So tell me, how did you discover the story of Varian Fry? When did he come to your attention?
So I was researching my last book, The Invisible Bridge, which also takes place during the Second World War. And I learned that there was a clause in the Franco-German armistice called the Surrender on Demand Clause, which meant essentially that Germany could demand the extradition of any German national or even former German national, because a lot of people had become stateless by that time. And I Googled Surrender on Demand to learn more about it. And up came this memoir by Varian Fry, who I had never heard of at the time. I was astonished when I started to learn about who he was and what he did, that in all my years of Jewish schooling, I had never heard of his project. I'd never heard of the thousands of people he saved, the vast majority of whom were Jewish. And at first I thought, oh, how great. You know, there'll be a little chapter in The Invisible Bridge that will mention this incredible work. But the more I learned, and especially when I started to research his college years and his pre-college years and find out who this human being was, the more I thought, oh my God, this person needs his own novel. And I felt that, in fact, the world should know more about him. And that's been the greatest pleasure over the last 10 years of working on this book, just getting to talk to people about him, getting to say, do you know that this person existed? Oh my God, who did he save? How did he do that? How did this one human being manage to have the chutzpah to get out from behind that desk and do this work that he was utterly unqualified for?
So now, when you started down that exploration, was it like a distraction? Did you leave your novel for, did you leave The Invisible Bridge and follow this, like, you know, the way you can get into an internet hole and suddenly 3 weeks later you're like, wait a minute, why am I researching Chevy Novas from, you know, 1982 or 79? I'm supposed to be writing a novel about the Holocaust.
Well, the funny thing about having this conversation with Ayelet Waldman here in front of all of you is that she knows that that's exactly what I did, because she heard me talking about it at the time. We'd be sitting on the beach in Maine. She'd be like, well, how's The Invisible Bridge coming along? I'd be like, well, you know, actually, have you heard of Varian Fry? I did go down that internet hole for a while. But it was fortunate that I did, because it was actually a research fellowship at the New York Public Library that brought me to New York. It was to be a research project for this novel, but I was still writing The Invisible Bridge at the time. So I spent a year at the New York Public Library with this wonderful fellowship and an office and access to the collections, ostensibly researching the flight portfolio, but actually finishing The Invisible Bridge. But I did assemble a great store of research during that time. And being in New York was fabulous, because I was close to Columbia, where there's a 27-box archive of all of his papers.
Amazing.
And ephemera and photographs, both from his time in Marseille and from the years that followed. So I could learn, you know, what the aftermath of this experience was like for him. Imagine having these 13 months of your life where suddenly you have this dire purpose, and whether you execute your job perfectly over the course of the day is going to determine whether people live or die. And then you're expelled from France because France has gotten wind of the illegal activities you've been carrying out to save refugees. So you go back to the States. And then how are you going to convince everyone that things are really as bad on the ground as you've seen them to be? How are you going to convince everybody that all of these writers and artists are in such severe danger that they must be a priority? I mean, I think it was extraordinarily difficult for him to get across to Americans at that time.
What did he do? How did he try? Did he write? Did he publish?
He did. He wrote articles for The New Republic, for The New Yorker, for The New York Times. And by the way, go to the New York Times archive. It's fabulous. You can look up Varian Fry. You can do a search for documents from 1940 to, let's say, 1950. And you can read his writings about his work in Marseille and about the war. And he was desperate to try to convince people that that this problem merited their immediate and urgent attention. But then he also wrote his memoir, and that was published in 1945. You can imagine how complicated that must have been, because at the time, people did not really want to read in this country about the ways that the United States had failed the threatened people of Europe at that time. They did not want to read about the United States' restrictive policies. And they also didn't want to hear Varian Fry who did have quite a heroic role, anguished about what more he wished he could have done. And so you can actually go to that Columbia archive and look at the drafts of his memoir with his editor's excisions, where his editor is saying, no, this is too dark. People are not going to want to read about this.
Wow. Wow. That's incredible. And what else was in that archive? What were in those 37 boxes? What kinds of things did you get to touch and read and see? And
well, they were amazing things. So there were dozens and dozens of letters from Varian Fry to his wife, Eileen, back at home, to his parents, to his friends, to artists who he was trying to find, to the New York office of the Emergency Rescue Committee, who he was trying to convince to send him more money and give him more time and argue his case to the U.S. consulate, because they really, by that time, really wanted him out. They felt that he was dangerous to the United States mission in France. And there are photographs that he took of the writers and artists who he was saving. They rented a villa outside of Marseille for about 9 months, and so there were these incredible parties and soirees and art exhibitions, and there are photos in the archive of those events. And then there are letters that he wrote after the war trying to raise still more money for his committee, because he realized that that the refugee problem was not going away.
Right.
But it's endless. It's truly endless.
Now, did you build, I mean, even when you're writing about a real person, you have to build a fictional character, because you're not talking to him. You don't get to hear his voice. You don't live with him. What did you use from those archives to create the character Varian Fry in the book, as opposed to the person, or, you know, as a compliment to the person?
Well, his voice, first of all. I mean, it was so amazing to read his voice in those letters. That was essential, I think. Mm-hmm. There's this wonderful letter where he describes what it's like when Maréchal Pétain was going to come to town. The leader of France at the time was going to come to Marseille. And so all the undesirables in town had to be rounded up and taken to prisons around town, but there wasn't enough room in the prisons for the 10,000 people who had to be rounded up. And so a lot of them were imprisoned in temporary holding spaces, like a ship, for example. So Varian Fry and his clients were imprisoned on a ship called the Sinaia for a number of days. And if you go into that archive, you can actually read about what it was like when the authorities arrived, searched the place, and dragged everybody out of the house, threw them in a van, took them to the police station, and then put them on this prison ship for a number of days. His voice in that letter was so rich and evocative that, you know, I felt like I could start to sort of feel and see him as a character. The cool thing is that that I took a number of those letters, and I asked Varian Fry's son if he wouldn't mind giving me permission to make a kind of mini archive on my website.
Oh, great.
And so if you want to read that letter about being in prison on the Sinaia, you can go to my website, which is just julieoringer.com. And on the flight portfolio page, there's access to documents. You can go and look at, you know, I think 8 or 9 documents from the archive. You can download them as PDFs and just look at them in the comfort of your home and get a sense for what his voice was like.
Remarkable.
But there were other things that really I felt I wanted to invent. There were certain things that about his experience that could not have been captured at the time. I felt like when I read his memoir, his voice was very stylized. You know, it sounded kind of like a spy movie.
Right.
And I thought, who is the person behind that? You know, what is he not telling us about what's going on in his life? The more I studied his history and the more I learned about his personal relationships, I realized that one of the things that he wasn't writing about at the time was that he had relationships with men.
Now, that's one of the things I want to talk to you about. How did you discover that? How did it become clear? Did you know it going in? When did you start to suspect?
Well, I didn't know it going in, because the first biography I read did not mention it at all. And then I read...
And in fact, that biographer very defensively wrote a letter to the editor. That's her.
Yes, that's right.
In the New York Times, insisting that, you know, on the truth of her biography, that he was not, in fact, gay. But of course, his own son also wrote a letter saying he was. So
Yes. Well, this is actually a fascinating thing that's unfolding right now. It seems that a lot of people are, in fact, quite invested in the idea of Varian Fry that has existed to this point, which was essentially a closeted Varian Fry. Mm-hmm. Despite the fact that there's plenty of historical evidence that exists around other relationships he had. So Martin Duberman has a wonderful biography of Lincoln Kirstein, in which Lincoln Kirstein describes to Martin Duberman his romantic relationship with Varian Fry in college. They started this marvelous magazine together called The Hound and Horn, and they were publishing people like T.S. Eliot and Juno Barnes, and you know, various iconoclasts of, you know, the first few decades of the century. And they also had a sexual relationship that kind of was a conflagration around the starting of this magazine and that sort of fell apart after a little while.
Was that the first thing you read that indicated to you, or what was the, where was the first, like, thread that you pulled?
I think that the first thing that that made me curious about that was Andy Marino's biography, A Quiet American, where he raises the question of whether Varian Fry might have had relationships with men. He talks a little bit about Varian's friend Stefan Hessel, who later became a quite exalted French diplomat and was the father of the Occupy movement. Mm-hmm. Stefan Hessel and his family were in the south of France at that time. And in his lovely memoir that was published in 2011, he writes about the relationship that he and Varian had at the time, where they would go away, they would sort of escape from Marseille for weekends together to the small towns of the countryside. And he writes that over the course of their time together, he became aware that Varian's affection for him had a romantic element, one that he returned and shared. And so he's pretty cagey about the details of the relationship, mm-hmm. but he writes about it in the context of, very clearly within the context of that having been a gay relationship. So I was curious about why it was that Varian Fry's life seemed to have kind of been derailed by his time in France. And I felt that it must go further. I felt that the reasons must go further than the nature of his work and the fact that it was so difficult for him mm-hmm. to continue it. And the more I realized that he had this complicated history around his sexual identity, the more I learned about his friendship with Stefan Hessel, the more I thought there should be a relationship at the center of this book that challenges the way he had lived before, that challenges the compromises that he had had to make in order to live his life to that point. Mm-hmm. And so because so many gay lives have not been able to be documented, and because those stories simply were not able to be told for so many years because people were afraid to record them, I felt like this was an area where fiction could actually help. Fiction might aid historical understanding in a way, through the creation of a character who was not real and who yet I thought might illuminate some element of this real person's life. Now, the really interesting thing that's happened over the last couple of weeks is that in response to some reviews that have come out that have asserted that there is no historical evidence of Varian Fry's being gay, Varian Fry's son has felt that it's very important to now inform readers and, you know, the rest of the world that, in fact, he has known that his father was gay for the last 30 years or so. And a lot of the evidence for his conclusion was not necessarily available to biographers, mm-hmm. like the one who we mentioned. And yet somehow I found plenty of evidence when I did my research.
It's so interesting to me that way that that biographer, I mean, I don't want to criticize her unduly, but that biographer and also Cynthia Ozick, who wrote the review in the New York Times, they seem so attached to this idea that he was a heterosexual, invested in this idea that he was a heterosexual, which seems so, it seems so peculiar to me now. And is it just plain old homophobia? Is it this idea of a biographer like, oh my God, I missed that box? You know, what is it? What explains that deep investment that people have in a particular vision of this historical character, no matter the evidence against it?
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is writer Julie Oringer, whose new novel is The Flight Portfolio. She's joined in conversation by Ayelet Waldman. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Well, we got to remember that Cynthia Ozick and I believe the biographer we were speaking about were both of Varian Fry's generation. I mean, they grew up in a historical context that was so different from ours around this particular issue. And so I can't fault them for simply having grown up differently, for simply having a different kind of background around the idea of homosexuality, generally speaking, of differences in sexuality, generally speaking. But I do think that we have to allow our understanding of who people were, historically speaking, to be fluid enough to evolve with our evolution of empathy for people who have differences in all of these regards. I think that at this particular moment, when difference is being challenged in a lot of ways in this country, and when there is a lot of fear around all of the multiplicities of human experience as they express themselves, I think we have to be particularly open to our shifting understanding of who people might have been in the past, now that we can talk about it freely. And I think also it's important to remember, as Varian Fry's son points out, that gay people were persecuted in the Holocaust. And in doing respect to an accurate rendition of what life would have been like back then, we have to remember that anybody who was gay was also scared if they were in Europe during those years.
One of the things that I found so exhilarating about that portrait is that we aren't used to seeing heroic historical characters, physically heroic, physically courageous, and courageous in every sense of the word, who are gay. And it was, I found it exhilarating to read about that character and inspiring. And I think that the same is going to be true for both straight and particularly gay readers, and I think particularly young gay readers, to find this character who can inspire them in the way that of, you know, the most courageous among us.
Well, I also hope that that's going to be true for women who read the book and who read about the incredible women who were involved in Varian Fry's organization.
Tell us about a couple of those.
Yeah, so there were two in particular who I love to talk about because they were just such large personalities. There was Miriam Davenport, who I've mentioned, who was an art historian who had studied at the Sorbonne. She was originally from Boston, and she came to the south of France from Paris during the pagaille. She ended up in the offices of the Emergency Rescue Committee in Marseille because she had come along with a number of artists who needed Varian Fry's help. Well, once he met her and understood how deep her artistic knowledge was, how well-connected she was, and how much she knew of the artistic community that had fled Paris, he thought, oh my God, I have to have her work for me. So she had this unbelievably complicated role. One of her primary jobs was to interview candidates for the Emergency Rescue Committee's aid. So she would sit down with an artist and say, well, tell me about your background. You know, where did you study? What school are you in? You know, where have you taught? Where have you exhibited? Can I see your work? Mm-hmm. Now, remember that these are people who had been fleeing, some of them for months and months, and some of them had no work with them whatsoever. And so in the case of an artist who was trying to make a case for himself, she would sometimes say, well, why don't you go down to the Old Port and do some sketches and then bring them back to me?
Amazing.
And sometimes on the basis of that work that they produced spontaneously, she would make a judgment as to whether or not they were as accomplished as they claimed to be.
Imagine making that sketch. Imagine knowing that your life depends on what you see and how you're able to translate to that to the page in a moment of such utter desperation and panic and despair.
I imagined it. And then one of her close friends was a woman named Mary Jane Gold, who was an American heiress from Chicago, who had come to Europe to go to finishing school in Italy. She went to this storied finishing school that was run by this very charismatic woman who taught her charges to be strong and independent and have a great time. And so Mary Jane Gold flew her plane all over Europe from one glittering playground to another for years. And then when the war began, she actually gave her plane to the French army. And she and Miriam Davenport went down to Marseille, and she began to become concerned with the plight of the refugees. And so she showed up in the Emergency Rescue Committee offices and said, look, I would really like to donate some money. Of course, Miriam had been cultivating her in this regard as a donor. But she also wanted to be involved in the refugee aid organization. She didn't just want to sit back and give dollars. She wanted to be there in the office, interviewing clients, talking to people, helping to find artists, doing the actual day-to-day work. And some of the work was pretty intense for her. So one of the things that she did was to try to get four prominent social democrats out of a horrifying concentration camp where they'd been held for months. She went down to this concentration camp and demanded to meet with the commandant. And when she met with the commandant, she said, why don't you come and meet me at my hotel tonight?
Wow.
And let's discuss what's going on with these four social democrats. And he did not actually meet her at the hotel, or at least that's the way the story goes. But the four social democrats were, in fact, released. And so that's an episode that is translated, is recorded and then translated into something a little bit different in the novel.
Remarkable. I mean, it must have been so delightful doing this research and finding one character after another who could just explode to life in the pages. I mean, that must you must have just been exhilarated just to be like, oh my God, that person. And she flew her plane. And I mean, to find out all of these larger-than-life people.
Yeah, but it was also terrible, right? Because there were too many great stories to tell. There were so many wonderful things I had to leave out. Like, one of the amazing things is that both Varian Fry and Mary Jane Gold had these charismatic dogs who they were passionately in love with. Varian Fry had this standard poodle named Clovis.
Did he brought with him, or he met, or he picked
he
up there?
Picked up there, yeah.
Okay.
And Mary Jane Gold also had a standard poodle, and they were ill-behaved, and they were always causing trouble. And Varian was, you know, alternately staying in hotels and in this beautiful villa. And Clovis was just a nightmare. He was not continent. He could not be controlled around food. And, you know, in the midst of doing this dire, life-saving work, Varian was also a dog parent. And I wish I could have had chapters to devote just to that in the novel.
Sadly, great. Anything else that you can think of that's like that you just couldn't? I mean, it's a big book in the best possible way, but is there anything else you had to prune that you're sorry about? I mean, look, you found Varian because you were working on The Invisible Bridge. Is there another book in there that you maybe shunted aside?
Do not ask me that question. so many books. Really, I mean, the artists' lives were totally fascinating. Huh. I mean, you know, what was going on in Max Ernst's romantic life at the time, how he met Peggy Guggenheim, and there was this instant connection between the two of them and this sort of explosion of love, and meanwhile, others were falling in love. And I mean, it was life didn't stop just because there was a war, just because everyone was imperiled. There were all of these stories that were unfolding. It could be hundreds of novels that came out of this time. My next novel is going to be set in America in the later 20th century.
I was going to ask, did you have any trepidation about staying in the period of World War II, going from one heavily researched historical novel about the period to another?
I mean, for a minute I did, and then I just thought, what the hell? This story is too great. I have to tell it. I want people to know about Varian Fry. I want people to know about his work. I don't care whether I write 2 or 10 novels that are set during World War II. His story had to be told.
That's great. So I think we're going to open this up to questions from the audience.
Not to keep throwing stones at your reviewers, but on the subject of the sexuality, Ozick said that, okay, she kind of gave you the sexuality of Varian Fry, but then she thought, it's kind of a stretch to say that gay people would be good at being spies. And I'm like, what? they dissemble. They have to play a part, and especially in that era. And every time I read a spy novel about, especially British security, British intelligence, they're all gay. Is that true? I mean, were there a disproportionate number of gay people in these sort of activities in your research?
Oh, that's a great question. My research was so focused on Varian Fry that I don't actually know the answer to that question. But I can tell you that Andy Marino, the biographer I mentioned, did speculate that a habit of hiding might have come in handy for somebody in Varian's line of work. My interpretation goes a little farther than that, I think. The conclusion that I came to had to do with empathy. It had to do with why it might have been that Varian Fry was willing to go to the lengths he went to, putting his own life at risk to save the endangered writers and artists. And it seemed to me that he was somebody who understood what it felt like to be marginalized. He was somebody who understood what it felt like to be told that he should not exist. And that at some level, even though it's impossible to draw any kind of a one-to-one connection, at some level, there had to have been a sense of empathy that was driving his work, that was causing him to do what he did for as long as he did. And so I think that must have come to some extent out of a feeling of otherness, and especially out of closeted otherness.
When I was reading about him and thinking so much about him, but the first time I read the book and also when I reread it in anticipation of our conversation, and then also read his son's letter to the New York Times, which talks about his father's probable bipolar disorder, I wondered also about that, about the idea that courage is so often tied inextricably to failures of impulse control.
Uh-huh.
Because if you have impulse control, mm-hmm. you are good at keeping yourself from doing dangerous things. Uh-huh. But if you are impulsive, then you often act dangerously, and sometimes that's in furtherance of, you know, a desirable goal. Sometimes that's in furtherance of your empathy, of your, you know, of all sorts of things. And it can be both negative but also remarkable.
I think that's a brilliant reading of his character. I love that. It was a question that I asked many times, you know, of myself and of this narrative. You know, what was it that that allowed him to take the risks that he took? And I did feel like so many times it was just that he couldn't help it. He had to do it. He couldn't stop himself from talking back to high officials in the French administration. He couldn't stop himself from recruiting the help of black marketeers who might be dangerous for him to associate with, because he just believed so strongly in his aim and in his mission. And so I think that it's amazing to consider how a failure of impulse control might actually have saved thousands of lives in wartime France.
I think so.
That's a brilliant read. Thank you, Ayala.
I think that's the magic of fiction, right? In what other medium do you get to inhabit the mind of another person? Do you get to immerse yourself and see what they see and hear what they hear and feel? You can't do it in film. You're watching them, right? You don't really do it in visual art, but to actually exist in the mind of a character, I think, is the project of fiction. And I think that kind of radical empathy is what makes all fiction, I think, inherently political, because you are engaging in that project. And I wonder, right now we hear a lot about invective about cultural appropriation and writers not presuming to inhabit the bodies and minds of people different from themselves, which would leave you with writing about Jewish women who live in New York and who are in their 40s, who have two children, and who are tall and thin. So I wonder if you might talk about that, because as someone who has over and over again in her fiction inhabited with such grace and beauty and competence and love and empathy all sorts of different people, talk a little bit about that, about the moment that we're in maybe and what that's like and how you find the courage to do this again and again.
Well, my first book was a short story collection that was very close to my own experience. And the second book, the novel, The Invisible Bridge, came out of my grandfather's experiences during the Second World War and was largely about his study of architecture in France before the war and his experiences in forced labor camps during the war. And boy, was it scary to take on that subject and to write from the point of view of somebody who was in a forced labor camp in Ukraine on a January night, you know, in 1942. I mean, I just thought, oh my God, what right does anybody who was not there have to write this story? But as I spoke to people who had been there and they told me their stories, what I kept hearing again and again is, I'm so glad you're writing this because these stories need to be told. Mm-hmm. I never heard, you don't have the right to write this story. Mm-hmm. Again, it was the idea of fidelity to the experience, doing the research that would allow me to really try to know those mm-hmm. people from the inside until they felt like they became my people. Mm-hmm. I actually feel like it was akin to the experience that Varian Fry had when he was in Marseille. I think that he saw the people he was saving, in a sense, as being other than him. They were endangered. They were artists. They were from another culture. Many of them were Jewish, and Varian Fry was not. But the experience of being there in France and getting to know them, living with them in this villa in the countryside, was empathy-inducing. And so by the time he left France, I really believe that he felt like he was fighting for his own people. The quality of fiction that you talk about, the ability of fiction to allow us to inhabit another human mind, of course that's political, because it's only out of empathy that we can feel emboldened to act. I mean, it really is necessary for us all to become active at this political moment for what we believe. And if fiction can aid in that process, then I don't care who you are writing about your subjects, as long as you're doing so with sensitivity and with the most ardent attempt at understanding, I think we have to enlist the help of anybody who can use whatever platform, whatever medium it is that they have access to elicit further empathy and to aid in the larger project of creating an America that is welcoming, that is accepting of all of its members, its citizens, and that is future-looking, that thinks about how we can become a beacon for good in the world instead of what we are right now.
That is such a beautiful conclusion that we're going to end right there.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was writer Julie Oringer, whose new novel is The Flight Portfolio. She was joined in conversation by Ayelet Waldman. The recording engineers of the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espelay, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pamintuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.